This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this week's show. I have something that we're going to do tonight that I'm pretty excited about because it involves multiple subjects that I like. We're going to be talking with John Steadman about H.P. Lovecraft and the Black Magical Tradition. And anyone who knows me knows I'm a huge, huge Lovecraft fan, and I'm also very interested in various forms of magic.
The opinions expressed by the...
And I should remember to make that stop. And so we're going to be talking to him in just a moment. Remember, we have a group now on Facebook if you want to join that and leave comments on stuff. We also have a forum that is freely available at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And, of course, a patron section. So you can get a little bit of extra content and help us out as we're slowly trying to work toward more shows a week. Right now it seems that we're getting almost two a week, most weeks. This week we might have actually three, two this coming week after this one. We will see how it all goes. But right now I want to welcome John Steadman to the show. Hey, John.
Thank you very much. Hello.
And H.P. Lovecraft and the Black Magical Tradition. What made you want to... The subtitle of this, too, is the Master of Horror's Influence on Modern Occultism. What made you want to write this?
Well, I've always been interested in ghosts and vampires and werewolves when I was very much younger. I used to read ghost story collections, and I used to collect famous monsters of filmland. I'm kind of an older gentleman, actually, because that was back when I was in middle school. And then I graduated to kind of more sophisticated reading material when I was in seventh grade, but I discovered Lovecraft about that time. And I found this book in a bookstore, and it had a very lurid cover on it. It was like called The Color Out of Space and Other Stories, and it had like a burning orange skull with a black background. And I figured I'd better buy this book because it probably had some really good stories. And I was sitting out there reading The Color Out of Space, which is Lovecraft's only science fiction story, and it really started causing chills down my back. And now, I'd been reading a lot of horror and ghost stories, and I'd never experienced that before. You know, I thought I was actually inured to that sort of thing, you know, but anything that could have an effect like that on me, and it was a beautiful day, too. It was like daylight, and it was nice and warm, and I was feeling chills, you know. So I was hooked on Lovecraft after that, and then when I got into high school, I kind of gravitated toward the practice of a cult. I found Aleister Crowley, of course. I discovered the satanic rituals and the satanic Bible. And I started doing magical rituals. And then when I got into college, I started writing my own rituals based on the Lovecraft mythos. So I kind of just gravitated toward this. And then when I got older and my skills had developed to such a point where I could actually write and consolidate my thinking, I started writing this book. You know, it took me 5 or 6 years to write. This is my first one. My second one is ready, and that one it only took me a year to write. So I've scaled my business, so to speak. I scale it down so I can do them faster. So I'm writing books now.
And this is your first book.
Yes.
The second one, I'm assuming we're going to have to wait a little bit for.
Yeah, well, I'm doing these interviews and I'm doing book signings and events because I want to sell as much of this book as possible because I have a very materialistic goal. I have an MBA in accounting and finance in addition to my literature degree, and I'm a very practical person in that regard. And I know that the publishing company, if I sell enough of the first one, they'll pay for the second one. You know, So I want to get the second one out. It's in the hands of the publisher right now, so I'm kind of working the circuit, so to speak. It's a good book, of course. I mean, it's not. It's well worth people buying, but, you know, I have a very practical, business-oriented view toward it as well.
Well, sure. I think you have to if you want to do stuff like this. In this book, you don't imply that Lovecraft necessarily was drawing massively from these other occult fields and stuff. I mean, Lovecraft very famously said he wasn't really interested in that type of stuff.
Well, he wasn't. Like, more or less, he was interested in it for background things for his story. The thing about Lovecraft, a lot of people are kind of surprised by him because everybody's heard he's a materialist and an atheist, and they wonder, if he's a materialist and atheist, why did he create a bunch of gods and goddesses? I mean, that's not something an atheist usually does. I mean, S.T. Joshi, the great Lovecraft scholar, he's an atheist, and he doesn't create gods. Most of them don't. Most of them actually debunk gods. And so you wonder why a guy like that would do that. But what I argue in my book is there was two sides to Lovecraft. I mean, he was a standard split personality. There was a daytime Lovecraft that was a mechanist, materialist, and atheist, and he denied the existence of supernatural beings. And then there was the night side Lovecraft, who was an avid dreamer, and he had these terrifying dreams. And he was very vividly drawn to weird fiction and weird stories through his whole life. And eventually, when he started delving into creative composition, he started writing about some of the things he was seeing in his dreams. An interesting thing about him is that when he started creating gods and goddesses, these weren't standard gods and goddesses. They were very sophisticated entities, and they conform very strongly to descriptions of the quantum world and the quantum universe. So he kind of, the scientific Lovecraft kind of spilled over into his supernaturalism. But the power of Lovecraft derives from the fact that he never reconciled these two parts to him. And so part of him doesn't believe in him. Part of him can create him vividly. I would say that's kind of like a personification of the way we all are. Like, I'm a magical practitioner, right? And you mentioned about chaos magic, right? Mm-hmm. When you get out there under the stars and you're doing a magical ritual, you're holding things like a wand or a sword, there's a part of you that thinks, what kind of a silly fool am I? Why is a grown man or a grown woman out here waving wands or chanting and stuff? That seems a very silly thing to do, right? But then there's another part of you where you understand that by doing this, you're actually engaged in something a little bit more profound than that. So I would argue that we both have the same elements of Lovecraft, and we can empathize with that. And I think that's the reason why his fiction is so powerful for people all the way into the 21st century.
Fair enough. One of the things you talk about it here early on is you mentioned the Crowley quote as Crowley defines magic. And of course, the way Crowley looked at it was that everything is magic in a sense. It's just low magic. Like picking up a glass is magic. But it's very low magic. And you kind of go away from that and define magic in a little more concrete terms in the book.
Yeah, well, you got to understand something. It's called H.P. Lovecraft and the Black Magical Tradition. A lot of people get upset by that. Like I was at a book signing and a Wiccan person came up. And she should have known better, for heaven's sakes. I talk about Lovecraft's influence on the Wiccan religion. The Wiccan is a black magical system, right? But the fact that I called it black magic really bothered her. And then there's a chapter on Lovecraft's influence on the Church of Satan. And that bothered her, too. She's worried about Satan. And what they do, they get this popular culture idea of black magic. And popular culture fosters that. You see the Harry Potter movies, right? What do you got? Voldemort, the Dark Lord, right? He's evil. And you look at the Star Wars movies, people like Darth Vader, and in the new Star Wars movie, which I haven't seen yet, you've got a character in black again, you know, wielding like a red sword, and then the good people have like blue and green kind of earth colors, and they dress in white, you know. So popular culture fosters that whole black and white thing, but I define black magic as simply magic you're using for knowledge and power, to gain knowledge and power. And it's good knowledge. It's not bad knowledge, and it's good power, not trying to dominate people, but it's basically for those motives. White magic, on the other hand, is magic used to achieve spiritual perfection. But there's no evil associated with any of these. Now, you could be a black magical practitioner and be totally ethical, or you could be a white magical practitioner that's very unethical. I would argue that Aleister Crowley was a white magician all of his life because his whole magical career was devoted to achieving spiritual perfection. But he was a very bad man ethically, very bad, evil in a lot of ways. And then conversely, a person might be a black magician, but they're actually a very ethical person. Whether you're good or evil depends on your behavior, basically. Not intent, but your behavior. I had one person say it derives by intent, but that's not true. Intent is only relevant in terms of badness or goodness if you actually act upon it, if your behavior does it. I could have the intent right now to kill 20 people, right? As long as that's in my head, it's not good or evil. It's just an intent. If I actually went out based on that intent and killed 20 people, then I would be an evil person.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I think Crowley was just a very complicated individual in general, but I mean, I don't think there's any argument that he was a white magician. He said so himself many, many times.
Yeah, but he also, Crowley liked to foster that image of being a Satanist.
Oh, yeah.
And a black magician, the wickedest man in the world.
Sure.
You know, any kind of publicity was good for him, but he ended up actually shooting himself in the foot about that because people started taking him at his word. You know, after
he almost seemed amused by that, though.
Like he was amused, but then what happened later on in life, like when his fortune ran out, he had an inheritance, and up until the Equinox period, where he actually was publishing the Equinox, he published all of his books at his own expense, very ornate books. His inheritance ran out about the time he went to America. That had been around 1914, and he was kind of living as an adventurer, basically trying to live off disciples and live off women, too, and anybody that would give him money. And at that point, he realized that his reputation was damaged by what he was doing, and he couldn't help himself. He was kind of like Donald Trump, right? Never knew when to shut up, won't listen to anybody, didn't care, like, here's Trump, the front runner, and he can't keep his mouth shut. You know, he can't control himself when he gets up there and gives speeches, and then he wonders why he's diminishing. And it was the same thing with Crowley. You know, he just couldn't keep his mouth shut. He had to keep going for the sensational. And after a time, people started believing that, and it damaged him. He couldn't get his he couldn't get himself published. He was actually kicked out of Italy by Mussolini because of his reputation.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let him into France. He wanted to take haven in France. They wouldn't let him into France, and he was considered just a bad person that nobody should associate with, and it damaged him. He was actually writing very good books in his later life, and he couldn't sell them. He couldn't get them published.
Yeah, yeah, but like Lovecraft, Crowley's way more popular now than he was during his own lifetime.
Yeah, but how gratifying is that? I mean,
I agree with that.
You know what I'm saying? Like Lovecraft, when he died in 1937, he thought he was a complete failure.
Yeah.
Never got a book published. He had got some stories published in Weird Tales and Astounding Magazine. Never made any real success at it. He had a following of people, but he thought he was an utter failure when he died.
And that's so unfortunate because he has had such a major impact on so many different levels of our culture and our society in general.
Well, that's what I argue. Like you notice that there's a lot of different approaches toward Lovecraft nowadays. The reason why I wrote this book is because I wanted to handle Lovecraft's connection with the occultism because I felt it needed to be done. You could find bloggings about this, chance articles, but nobody had done a full-length study like this. But if you look around, Lovecraft right now not only has a significant literary influence like S.T. Joseph and others, he now he's being studied in colleges. His contribution of cosmicism to English literature is recognized by most scholars and academics. But in addition to that, look at the influence on popular culture, the video games, the movies.
Yeah.
Look at the influence on
music.
Literature. You do a heavy metal show,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, and we've done entire blocks of music inspired by Lovecraft before.
Yeah, music. But look at the other things, too. Like, there's a whole subgenre of literature, the Cthulhu mythos fiction,
yeah,
which is going on. Now, no other writer that I know of, no other horror writer, even Edgar Allan Poe, has actually inspired that kind of a thing. And then let's look at him from a different standpoint, too. You got this Jason Colavato. He wrote The Cult of Alien Gods. I don't know if you've had him on your show before.
I know who he is, though.
Very notorious skeptic. He
yeah.
couldn't stand my book, by the way, but because he couldn't get past the fact that it had a magical premise.
Hmm.
You know, he didn't realize that I was approaching magic from kind of a skeptical standpoint. He couldn't get past the fact of the magical thing. He wrote a book, The Cult of Alien Gods, where he argues that Lovecraft was actually the progenitor of the alien astronaut theory, which means that Lovecraft is actually responsible for the whole UFO thing. Eric von Daniken, The Chariots of the Gods, all that derived from Lovecraft. There's a guy in Cairo, Egypt. His name's Graham Harman. He's a speculative realist, and he classifies Lovecraft as an important contributor to the speculative realist form of philosophy. So he's got Lovecraft up there right next to Martin Heidegger, Picasso, and other speculative realists, and he's claiming he has an important influence on Western philosophy. Think about that. I mean, the man's had influences on all these different levels.
Yeah, yeah. And I never thought about that, about him having the sort of lost civilization and ancient alien influence, but I guess he would have, because he's the one who really started pushing that sort of an archetype on people. Not that other people hadn't
That's
written
right.
about it, but he did it in such a way that it really just stuck in people's brains.
Yeah, well, in the Shadow of Time, he views that there was a race of, they called them the Great Race, and they came to Earth during the Triassic period, which is like way before mankind. I mean, the Triassic period, I don't remember the dates, but man didn't come around until like 200,000 years ago or so during the Cro-Magnon period, I think they call. So this was way before man. And these people colonized Earth in the Triassic period, and they did mental exchange, and they had these enormous libraries. So they were promoting world culture at that time. And then they actually, he makes a little hint that these people created man, this race created man. They kind of, man was kind of running around as an ape, and they kind of promoted the evolution of man because they were thinking they could use him as servants in some way. And then they kind of let the evolution of man take its course, you know. So they didn't do anything more with man because man was kind of hard to manage once it started to evolve. But, you know, all that is an alien astronaut theory. These aliens came from other cultures, colonized the Earth, and they jump-started the evolution of mankind. Now, that story was written in 1934.
Yeah.
Way before Eric Van Daniken, way before the 60s UFO craze. And Colavado makes a very convincing argument, all circumstantial, of course, you can't prove it. You know, but it's all circumstantial, but circumstantial cases do work in court. And it works pretty well in that book.
I'm not sure it would be, I could see him having an influence on what people perceived as a UFO phenomena, but the phenomena itself seems to have been with us going back into time, not necessarily as aliens, but as something, whether it be the fairy faith or whatever, having the same archetype to it. So, I mean, I think...
I agree with you. I mean, where it is there was something going on, right? Like the quantum physicists say, they're not always sure where it is. They'll call it a quantum effect. Not sure where it is, but something's happening, right? So I agree with you. There was something going on. People were seeing things, they were experiencing something. But what happened when people like Von Daniken came along, they imposed the theory, the alien astral theory, on what was happening. And that's where the argument is. They argued that Lovecraft was responsible for the theory. But he's not. He didn't actually cause the aliens to come or anything like that, or he didn't have anything to do. He wasn't an alien himself, but he actually did progenerate the theory itself.
Interesting.
It might not be true. That theory might not be true. You could explain that from a paranormal standpoint, too.
No, but I think the ancient alien, I mean, like I said, there are books written before Lovecraft's about Atlantis and Lemuria and stuff, but he definitely sort of popularized the idea as well, or helped popularize the idea.
Well, you can get Nobel Prizes for doing that. You can.
Now, what was Lovecraft's inspiration?
Well, Lovecraft just liked weird tales, basically. He always liked reading weird tales. He'd read all those magazines before he got published in. He wasn't really interested so much in magical theory. He was interested in magical elements so that he could use them as a trappings to his story, but he wasn't interested in magical theory per se. And I think I make that real clear, but his influence were those crazy dreams I was talking about. You know, he had all these weird, vivid dreams, and then his interest in weird fiction. And what's interesting about Lovecraft, when you look at his fiction, he does it totally different than anybody else. I mean, there are no standard werewolves, vampires, or ghosts, or anything like that. It's a totally unique series of stories, and he never does the same thing twice. Like, you'll read one story, and you know it's written by Lovecraft, at least stylistically, but it's always something different. You know, he never repeats himself in terms of, always repeats himself in terms of style, but never in terms of content. And that's very amazing about him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he may have connected some of the stories and created an overall idea behind a lot of them, but it was very different stories he was telling in each story.
And that's revolutionary, too. Like, think of Edgar Allan Poe for a minute. Like, Poe's got certain themes that crop up from story to story. The dying woman, you know, the idea of being buried alive and then coming back. All those themes kind of proliferate, the dying beautiful woman and coming back, and they all proliferate throughout a lot of his major stories, like Ligeia, The Fall of the House of Usher, Berenice, stories like that. But in Lovecraft, you don't see that kind of pattern at all. It's always something totally new. You'll read a story, and then it'll be a different take. And then some of the elements come in, like the Pantheon, the great old ones. They'll come in from time to time, but they're recast. And so they're looked at from a totally different view a lot of times. Sometimes from a science fiction standpoint, like they're actually alien astronauts. Sometimes from a quantum physics aspect, where they're actually part and parcel of alternate dimensions, sometimes from a pure magical standpoint in the traditional sense, you know. So it's always a little bit different. I find that totally charming about Lovecraft.
And one of the things, of course, he also did is he dealt a lot with dreams, and a lot of these stories were inspired by his dreams, if I'm not mistaken. But he created entire dream worlds that his characters would go into. And one of the things you say in here is that maybe in those dreams he was actually contacting other things without being aware of it, or being influenced by things without being aware of it.
People made that argument. The problem with that kind of an argument is that you can't prove it. That's why I don't like those kind of arguments. I mean, I'm actually trying to redefine magic and things like that, and I don't like it if there's not a theory for it. The problem with, like, astrology, for instance, magicians will claim there's an intimate connection between the plants and mankind, and sometimes we see that, like when there's a full moon, there's renewed activities in mental institutions. It has an effect on women's menstrual cycles. It has an effect on moods and emotions. So there is some empirical evidence that there's a connection between the moon and presumably other plants too, but there's no theory that explains that. And that bothers me, that there's no theory that explains it. So I kind of tend to be skeptical towards something like that. And Lovecraft tended to be skeptical, too. And there are people like Peter Lavanda. You know Lavanda, of course, the author of The Dark Lord. He claims that there was like some kind of psychic connection between H.P. Lovecraft and Aleister Crowley. He claims that the god Cthulhu in Lovecraft's Call of Cthulhu was actually connected to a god in one of Crowley's holy books. But the problem was there's actually no evidence for that, and the speculation strikes me as being very specious. You know, it's just something that I really find it very difficult to accept. He'll make arguments like this. He'll claim that in a story like The Call of Cthulhu, it was actually written in 1926, but one of the plot strands in the story takes place in New Orleans in 1907. And now in 1907, Crowley was writing the holy books. And he had a character that was like a fish kind of an entity that doesn't really resemble Cthulhu at all. But he's claiming just because Lovecraft had that plot strand in 1907 and that Crowley wrote the holy book in 1907, he's saying that proves it. Now, I don't like that kind of reasoning. You know, that's not, there's no theory there to explain that kind of psychic connection. And to equate one of Aleister Crowley's holy guardian angel, Eiwaz, or this entity in the holy book, it just seems to me to be specious. It doesn't seem to have any basis. But people make the argument you just made, that he was unconsciously in connection with real extraterrestrial entities. But I tend to doubt that.
Okay. Let's move on to the Necronomicon a little bit. And there's been a lot of people claiming to have the real Necronomicon. And Lovecraft flat out says he made it up.
He did make it up.
Yeah.
So, I believe he made it up entirely, but you've got to understand something about the Necronomicon. It doesn't really matter as long as it works.
Right.
Like in Chapter 3, I talk about kind of what I call them the spurious Necronomicons. And there are a lot more of those, by the way. In my original version of the book, I look at a lot of other different Necronomicons. In Number 4, I talk about the Simon Necronomicon. Mm-hmm. And Simon was one of the earliest magical practitioners back in the 70s. In the 60s, who actually argued that Lovecraft's entities were real extraterrestrial entities. They were Sumerian gods and goddesses. And he actually has some similarities phonetically between them, which aren't really convincing. I would argue that Simon's Necronomicon is like the other ones. It's kind of a fabrication. However, the reason why I devote an entire chapter to it, because I've used some of the rituals in that book, and they actually work. They actually work. So I would argue that the book is very effective from a magical standpoint as opposed to some of these other ones. But I would argue also that it really doesn't matter if you're using a fictional book or not, because I argue that the line between fictional and reality is very difficult to define, and it doesn't really matter in the final analysis.
I would think as long as you have some level of belief in what you're doing, it's going to have an effect.
That's what the chaos magicians say. They say, like, the conscious thought sometimes has to be layered down, you know, so you don't really know what you're saying. Like, when you go into the magical intellectual decompression chamber, as Anton LaVey would call it, you don't really know what you're saying at all. It's layered down, so the conscious mind hasn't got anything to hook into, and then the magical effects work. And that's kind of interesting because it gets all the preconceptions out of your mind. But I don't believe that you can make a case that Lovecraft's entities are actually connected to Sumerian entities. Occultists claim they are, that there's a direct connection, but I have to see proof for that before I would accept that.
And it seems like every time they say stuff like that, it's very kind of sketchy, tenuous sort of connections.
Yeah, like the Lavanda stuff I was talking about. But does it make any difference? Like, you could argue that Christianity is actually based on a fictional concept, too. I mean, back during the time when Moses and the Israelites were actually imprisoned by the Egyptians, God was actually one concept among many, the God of Abraham, the prophet Abraham. And he was a monotheistic God. And what happened back then, you could argue that Moses kind of popularized that God because he was a very powerful magician. He did all sorts of things that kind of he took the slaves out of Egypt. He parted the Red Sea. He did all those plagues. He conquered Pharaoh's magicians. So he kind of sensationalized that kind of belief in God. And you could say, taking it from there, that God slowly developed to where he was now. He might not have made it otherwise if it hadn't been sensationalized. But think about, like, God, there isn't any real evidence for the existence of God. But I would argue that God is a very powerful force. And why is it that powerful? Because look at all the people that believe in him. You've got whole religions based on people pray to God, they worship God, they write about God. And what that does is it feeds energy into the concept of the God of Abraham, just like feeding electricity into a car battery or something. Now, I would argue that Lovecraft's great old ones are very similar to that. With the rise of popular culture, people writing about, like Cthulhu and the other ones, people believing in me, writing about them in my book here. In Chapter 5, I talk about all the great old ones and try and give some account to what they actually are. I'm feeding energy into this, magical practitioners are too, so you can use that energy. Whether it's an actually ontologically existing entity that's really out there, like the Christians claim God's really out there, that's a question we can't really verify. We're a magician's only interested in the power. It's like when you walk into a room, right? You got a light switch. If I turn on the light switch, I'm happy because that's what it's supposed to do. I turn it off, it goes off. I don't care about things like circuit breakers. I don't care about linemen going up there to make sure all the things are connected. All I want to happen is the lights to come on. That's what magic is.
Fair enough. I have often wondered if, say, 1,000 years from now, Lovecraft's work won't have become its own religion with the same strength as many religions today.
It's happening right now. Right. I think it's happening right now.
But I think we know, at least we know who Lovecraft was and stuff. In 1,000 years' time, how much stuff is going to be lost where we don't realize he was a fictional writer at one point.
Oh, I think they'll always know that, Bill. It'll be like Aleister Crowley. I mean, Aleister Crowley's Thelema system turned into a religion now. Doesn't have very many followers. They have a lot of... And I was a member of the OTO for a while when I was younger. I went up to the second degree magician, and then I decided that Crowley was not... I couldn't really accept him as being the prophet of the new eon. They got like about maybe 5,000 or 6,000 members worldwide, kind of small, but they're devoted to Crowley. I would argue that Lovecraft has more followers than that. I don't think most of them would consider themselves a religion. But right now we have magical practitioners. They're trying to institutionalize it, so to speak. We got this guy, Donald Tyson, who's actually created something called the Order of the Old Ones. And he's actually turned Lovecraft into a white magical system where what you do, you actually mentor astrally, and he believes in the old nonsense about the astral plane stuff. You achieve an astral connection with different of the great old ones, and they kind of mentor you to spiritually perfect yourself. Now, that's not what Lovecraft's fiction's all about, but he's actually built a whole magical system and a whole white magical framework around Lovecraft's concepts. And a lot of the Satanists are doing the same thing, you know. So there's already attempts right now in the 21st century of actually turning Lovecraft into a magical system. And remember, magic came before religion, right?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, Moses was parting the Great Sea before there were Christians, right? These weren't Christians. These were slaves that he helped lead out of Egypt. These were not Christians, not yet. In fact, when Moses went up on Mount Sinai, they lapsed into idol worship. They were about as far from Christians as you could get. While he was getting the Ten Commandments, they were worshiping golden idols and acting the way Aleister Crowley acted in 1920 at the Abbey of Thelema. So there were no Christians yet. So magic preceded religion. And I would argue now that these magical systems they're actually utilizing the Lovecraft mythos will someday probably blossom into a full-fledged religion. And then Lovecraft, and in my chapter 2, I call him Prophet of the Aeon of the Great Old Ones. I'll argue that Lovecraft was viewed as a prophet of this new religion.
Can you explain to people who are not familiar with Lovecraft who the old ones are and who the elder gods are? Because those are the two main elements there in his cosmic dramas.
Yeah, I'll tell you, popular culture has embraced the whole idea of the conflict between the elder gods and the old gods. The mythology goes that the elder gods somehow rebelled, the old ones rebelled from the elder gods, and there was kind of like a war between the gods and the heaven. And then the old ones were imprisoned by the elder gods, like Cthulhu supposedly buried somewhere in the sunken city of Rylai beneath the Pacific Ocean. And there's magical symbols from the elder gods that keep him in prison, although you can still access him through your dreams and through your astral plane, according to Tyson. You know, but that mythology is not really in Lovecraft at all. Lovecraft has these very interesting entities. And if you study the entries, I've actually written a piece I finished about 2 weeks ago, and I'm going to shop it around. It's called H.P. Lovecraft's Cosmology and Quantum Physics. And Lovecraft uses these elder ones and these mythological constructs to articulate his view of the universe and the cosmos. And they're very sophisticated. I argue that Azathoth, which is one of the great old ones, is nothing more than a personification and a metaphorical framework of the Big Bang Theory. If you look at entities like Yog-Sothoth, they appear like a nuclear chaos. So these entities are very sophisticated quantum entities. In Lovecraft, there was no war between the elder gods and the other ones. In fact, Lovecraft only makes very slight allusions to other gods than the old ones, and they're kind of elder gods, but he kind of just mentions them in passing. There was never any war, you know. So I view Lovecraft's interpretation of the creation as being like in a quantum effect, and there was really no war. But of course, New Age people and the mythologists have this whole thing about good versus evil. The old ones are evil, the older gods are good, and they're interested in our welfare. Lovecraft didn't believe gods and goddesses as such were interested in our welfare at all.
Okay. One of the things you do really well with this book is you kind of run down different magical systems and explain the basic beliefs behind them, and then talk about how that connects into stuff Lovecraft was talking about. And let's talk about a little bit about voodoo and how that connects in.
Yeah, now the first two chapters in the book, and I had to be very deliberate there because Lovecraft had no influence on voodoo rituals at all. Voodoo's been around a long time. I would argue that voodoo was like the original religion, the serpent worship in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in existence way before we talked about the emergence of, that was way before the emergence of stuff in the Middle East, the original Sumerian gods, the worship of the serpent. The serpent is like the original deity for people. And I would argue that Lovecraft had no influence on voodoo rituals per se, unless it's modernistic voodoo. And a lot of modernistic voodoo practitioners, like Michael Boltrix of the Cult of the Black Snake, he actually adopted Lovecraft's views for his own voodoo cult, but it wasn't standard voodoo. The voodoo that I talk about, the Afro-Caribbean thing coming directly from Africa, that actually has no connection magically with Lovecraft in terms of the rituals. I was very careful in that first chapter because Lovecraft didn't really influence religion, but what he did was he influenced the kind of quantum interpretation of the voodoo entities. It's like in that book, I talk about the voodoo pantheons, and I talk about their view of the voodoo beliefs of the cosmos. And there's a connection between Lovecraft, but it wasn't a direct influence. Same thing in the Wiccan religion. Like the Wiccan religion, I would argue that a lot of the postmodernistic Wiccan practitioners have adopted Lovecraft, like the character Costantinos. He's actually written 7 books for Llewellyn, and he incorporated Lovecraftian themes into some of his Wiccan rituals, you know. But the classic Wiccan religion, again, was influenced more theoretically and philosophically by Lovecraft rather than the rituals themselves, you know. So the first two chapters is kind of like more of a philosophical or intellectual kind of connection. In the last 3 chapters, so I look at the influence on Kenneth Grant's Typhonian OTO, and then I look at in terms of the Church of Satan and then the Chaos Magic Pacts, and all these practitioners frankly acknowledge that Lovecraft was a predominant influence on not only their theory and philosophy, but also their actual magical workings.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with John Steadman.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we're talking with John Steadman about his book, H.P. Lovecraft and the Black Magic Tradition, Black Magical Tradition, The Master of Horror's Influence on Modern Occultism. And we do have a question from a listener in the chat room. He wanted to know, let's see here. Oh, if there's anything, if there's any evidence whatsoever that Lovecraft thought Azathoth was a personification of the Big Bang.
Okay, well, actually, in the latter half of my new essay, I argue that he, first of all, Lovecraft was up on all the modern scientific theories. He started out reading people like Ernest Haeckel's Riddle of the Universe, so he had kind of a steady state view of the cosmos, where the cosmos always existed and it was always going to exist. And then he actually, the Big Bang Theory came about. First of all, Einstein did his special theory of relativity, and then his general theory of relativity, and that was around, I think, 1915, and that was a basis for, like, the Big Bang concept of the universe, the whole idea of the general theories of relativity. It's based on that. And then the first one of those proposed was in 1927, and that was by a guy named Georges Lemaître. I'm not sure how I pronounce his name. He was a Belgian philosopher and actually a Roman Catholic priest, too. And he proposed the first original view of the Big Bang. Now, Lovecraft was aware of that, and he read these scientific findings, and he responded to them in his letters. So I argue that Lovecraft, and about that time was when Lovecraft was developing his concept of Azathoth. That was around like 1926. Azathoth first appears in The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadith, and then subsequently to that. So Lovecraft had already become aware of the Big Bang. He was kind of incorporating the concept into his own personal philosophy by trying to respond to it. He resisted the temptation of the Big Crunch, okay? The Big Crunch is those people that believe that we have a closed universe, the expansion of space reaches a certain level, and then gravity kicks in, and then it contracts and it destroys the universe. Lovecraft had a little difficulty with that concept. But as for the creation of the universe, he had no problems about that. Before, you know, in a steady-state view, he didn't believe the universe was created. They had always existed. So he'd actually modify his philosophy. But about the time he was developing the concept of Azathoth, he was wrestling with the idea of the Big Bang. So, yes, I would argue that the Big Bang does express Lovecraft's theories. And I go into detail about that in the book. I look at it from the standpoint of the creation itself. And then actually, 10, it's like 10 to the minus 34th power a few seconds after the Big Bang, which is about as far as we can go back to interpret it, when the universe was actually created, and it happened all at once. At that point, there was radiation, and he associates Azathoth with radiation. So we've got Azathoth before the Big Bang. We've got a concept of Azathoth associated with radiation during the Big Bang. And then his concept of the great old ones apocalypse, where everything's actually going to go to ruin, it's viewed as like when the great old ones come back, the universe is destroyed. That is a Big Crunch, you know. So I make the argument that Azathoth, yes, indeed, is a metaphor for the whole Big Bang concept in all three of its permutations.
And he also worked in concepts of quantum theory, didn't he?
Yeah, and the good story for that one to read would be The Dreams in the Witch House, which is one of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
His main magical practitioner is actually accessing quantum realms by the use of magical, strange designs, drawing different symbols and stuff, and he can access it. He's kind of brought in by a witch, and the witch would use quantum higher mathematics and quantum physics to actually traverse alternate dimensions. So if you want a good read there, read The Dreams in the Witch House, where it talks more about the quantum realms and the whole theory of the wave and the energy dichotomy, the fact that the particles or quanta share a wave and they're actually particles as well, based on the general theory of relativity.
Nice. All right. Let's talk about Kenneth Grant for a bit. I started out reading. I think I started reading. What was the first Grant book I read? It was the one where he deals with Crowley and I think Dion Fortune, A Magical Revival. I think it was the first one from Grant I read, and I really liked Grant's stuff. He started to lose me a little when he got deep into the whole Lovecraft Typhonian stuff, though.
Yeah, well, the problem with Grant is that he's very difficult to read because he believed in gematria, which Crowley kind of perfected in 777. And gematria, what you do is you add up the numbers of different things, and then it has like some kind of occult significance. If you read Grant, he'll be talking kind of sanely for a minute, and then suddenly you've got paragraph after paragraph, 4 + 7 = this, and then if you divide it by that, and it's all basic mathematics. It's certainly not Euclidean or even non-Euclidean geometry, so it's not very complicated. But he sees a connection between the universe and these numbers, and it starts kind of wearing you out after a while, you know.
Yeah.
And he repeats himself constantly from books to book, and what I do in my chapter, I kind of whittle it down, basically. But what Grant did, basically, is he actually changed, and Grant, I would argue, is probably the most creative occult scholar after Aleister Crowley, of course, because what he did is he redefined the OTO. Aleister Crowley's OTO was a paternalistic system. The man is supreme, the woman is secondary, and the combination of the man and woman during sex magic will generate the fluids, which the practitioners use to act the same way that the Christians use the body and blood of Christ to create magical effects, to perfect themselves. Only Crowley's magicians use it for use the sexual fluids for the same thing, but it's the same goal, spiritual perfection. What Grant did is he actually turned the paternalistic OTO into the a maternalistic system where the goddess was predominant, so the power came from the goddess, very similar to what the Wiccan religion, where the high priestess is predominant. And then he explored, Aleister Crowley tended to explore like the light side of the Tree of Life, the entities that inhabit the Tree of Life. And the Tree of Life I have not much patience with because it's like a two-dimensional projection onto the universe, which just isn't true. You know, the universe is more complicated than just two-dimensional.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so I don't like this two-dimensional kind of thing. What Grant did is he very creatively looked at the backside of the Tree of Life. So he kind of turned the Tree of Life upside down, and he was exploring the kind of the dark side of the Tree of Life. He called it the Tree of Evil or the Tree of Death. And he was exploring all these odd entities that dwell on the dark side. One of his books is The Night Side of Eden, and that's my favorite one, where he's got all, the reason why I like it is from a practical, magical standpoint. He goes through these entities, which are known as the Quiloptic entities. They live in the tunnels of Set, and they're behind the regular light side of entities. And he's got a whole description of these things. It's based on a brief outline that Crowley gave in the Equinox, and he's got ways to kind of contact these things. But other than that, Grant's system was actually the same kind of thing as Lovecraft, or not Lovecraft, Crowley's, in that it was sex magic. So he was doing sex magic rituals. But the one I think all of you should read, if you like Kenneth Grant, you should read the Hecate's Fountain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these books are very expensive,
yeah,
by the way. I bought all these books like in the 70s when they first came out, and they were real cheap then. You could get them like for $20 or $30. Now I understand that a lot of these books, you're paying like, since Grant is dead, and he only gets published by these specialty firms, you know, like Scoob was publishing him for a while, you're spending like sometimes $3,000 or $4,000 for one of these books.
Yeah.
And so they're very expensive, you know, but if you can get your hands on, and what I suggest you do if you want to buy them cheap, like I'd read all of Grant except for the very last one, and after Grant died, I wanted to read that, and it was a terrible price. It was like $5,000. I wasn't going to pay that because I knew that most of the book would be that silly gematria stuff, and it would kind of make me gag anyhow. So what I did is I actually found it online. I found a PDF, and I just downloaded the whole. I printed out the whole thing. Now, luckily, I work at a college where I don't get charged for print credits. It would have probably cost me about 50. It would have cost me probably 50 bucks to print that out if I had to pay for it. But that's better than 5,000.
Yeah.
Right. You know,
I remember picking them up back in the 90s, and they were like $40 to $60 for each one I picked up.
Yeah. that's about what they were. But now, you know, if you go, I wanted to buy them because I like books rather than PDFs, if you want my honest opinion. I'm an older generation guy. I'd rather hold a book in my hand
than read
on the screen. But $5,000, for God's sakes. You know,
yeah.
So I download that one. And I suspect you can probably get Hakati's Fountain in some kind of PDF or for free, too. So I'd advise you to do that. That book is good because it's got actual rituals in it, and they incorporate the Lovecraftian themes. So it's a little bit more than kind of the gematria thing, because you actually see some of the practice of the new Isis Lodge, which is what Grant called his version of the OTO. By the way, he was expelled from the OTO because he actually inverted Crowley's system completely. So he was expelled.
While claiming that this is what Crowley wanted all along.
That's what he argues in Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God. It's a very creative argument. I don't know if it's a valid argument. The OTO USA rejects it, of course, although they're very democratic about Kenneth Grant because they realize his contribution to occult scholarship. But, you know, they view it as a misinterpretation of Crowley.
And you quote a little bit of Grant in here on some of the rituals he conducted. And that's another thing that I always felt lost me a little, like they were written in such a way that they were kind of like a story. And I'd be like, you're just making this up, aren't you?
Yeah, well, you know, he probably fictionalized a lot of it. What bothers me about Grant is he didn't actually put the text to the rituals. And that bothered me a little bit. He claimed that they were a little repetitious, and so he didn't want to have a lot of repetitious thing. But that seems like a cop-out to me, because every book he's written, he constantly repeats himself in terms of philosophy and his gematria and stuff, and it carries over from one book to another. And by the way, when Grant started out, he didn't incorporate Lovecraft into Crowley at all. He started out comparing Lovecraft's mythos to Aleister Crowley's system, and that was in the Magical Revival. In the other book, I forget what. No, it was a Magical Revival, one of his first books. But only gradually over time, when the Simon Necronomicon came out, and then Grant kind of incorporated that into his system too. And then toward the end of his books, like in the Outer Gateways and then those other books, it was full-fledged. Lovecraft was a magical practitioner, and he was dealing with the same kind of Sumerian entities that Crowley dealt with. So he kind of adopted Lovecraft wholeheartedly, but he kind of kept him at arm's length when he first started writing.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Austin Osmond Spare, and he was kind of like one of the original chaos magicians.
Yes, he sure was, and I talk about him in that final chapter where I talk about the chaos magic packs. He was probably one of the most creative occultists at the time, and he was a member of Aleister Crowley's OTO for a while, but the men just didn't get along very well together. You know, because Austin Osmond Spare was just such an original person. He developed this system that really bears no resemblance to Aleister Crowley's system at all, so you couldn't expect him to stay long in the OTO at all. But his views, his whole idea, the nether, and I talk about that a little bit in my book, the Zos and the Kai occultists, all that is actually the foundation of modern chaos magicians, so I had to have a chapter on him. And you've got to realize something here in this book. I mean, like I say, this book is for fans of science fiction and horror, so I don't go into detail. I give you enough information where you can understand it, but then if you want to explore these things further, go out and get these books. I mean, you can order Austin Osmond Spare's books through, and those are probably real expensive too, you know,
probably,
nowadays.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can get all those books. You can get all of Grant's books and stuff. So I give you the text and I talk about what they're trying to do in very clear language, but I only have so much space in this book, and my interest is basically in Lovecraft's influence. Lovecraft had no influence on Austin Osmond Spare. I don't think Austin Osmond Spare even knew who Lovecraft was. And I'm not so sure Crowley knew who Lovecraft was. And Lovecraft knew who Crowley was, of course, because Crowley was sitting there over in the Abbey of Thelema advertising himself as the wickedest man in the world. You couldn't if you picked up a newspaper in London or even in America, you couldn't avoid seeing that, you know. So Lovecraft knew who Crowley was. I don't think Crowley knew who Lovecraft was at all.
A lot of people didn't know who Lovecraft was, so that's not surprising. When you talk about Wicca, you start, there's almost like two different stages of Wicca. There's the original Wiccan sort of the witch cults and stuff, and that's what Lovecraft draws some inspiration from. And then there's the modern version of Wicca that Gardner pretty much started in the, was it the 60s?
Yeah, it was about 1960. You know, back in the 50s, they still had the law against the practice of witchcraft, so you couldn't actually publish a book promoting Wiccan unless it was a fictional book, you know. Right. But then they repealed that witchcraft law in Britain, and then at that point, people were, of course, working behind the scenes. They were doing Wiccan rituals anyhow. They didn't always call that. They called it witchcraft back then, but Gardner kind of got the whole ball rolling. By the way, Crowley, he collaborated with Gardner, and Crowley wrote a lot of the original Book of Shadows originally, because Gardner was actually initiated into the OTO by Aleister Crowley. So the two collaborated for a while, but what happened, they worked all the Crowley stuff out later on, you know, because a lot of Wiccans just didn't like the Crowley, and because Crowley was really kind of obsessed with sex and sex magic, and the Wiccans weren't about that so much. They liked sexual polarity, but they weren't interested in what Crowley was doing at all. So they worked all that out of the Book of Shadows eventually. But I think I lost touch with that question. Oh, yeah, Lovecraft's influence. Lovecraft was heavily influenced by some of the earlier documents of the Wiccan, like Margaret Murray's The Witch Cult in Western Europe. He actually studied that book very closely, because when he actually alludes to rituals, he'll actually follow the whole Wiccan tradition of, like, the Sabbaths. You know, the he focuses basically on the Halloween Sabbath and then the April 30th Wapergisnacht Sabbath as well. You'll notice in the Dunwich Horror, Wilbur Whately performs his magical rituals on either one of those two Sabbath days, you know. So Lovecraft actually followed the Wiccan in terms of that, but he didn't so much follow the rituals or anything like that.
Yeah. And when you talk about Crowley being involved in the creation of Wicca, you can kind of see that in the Wiccan Reed, which is very similar to Crowley's statement, "Do as thou wilt."
Yeah, well, Crowley stole all that, by the way. If you read Lawrence Sutin's book, The Do What Thou Wilt, which is one of the best biographies of Crowley, it's even better than these modern ones because it doesn't whitewash Crowley. Some of these writers, like Tobias Curtin, he's written a biography of Crowley recently. And then The Beast in Berlin, which is a study of Aleister Crowley's visit to Berlin in the 1920s and the 1930s. And they're very good books, you know, but Curtin tries to whitewash Crowley a little bit. And what I like about Sutton is he doesn't do that at all. Oh. You know, he lays out the truth about Crowley, both sides of it, and he lets the reader judge. I like that thing about Crowley, but I think I'm losing touch with the question here. What was the question again?
Well, actually, my question was going to be, didn't MacGregor Mathers have something to do with the whole Wiccan formation as well?
Who?
Mathers? Wasn't he involved?
Oh, not really. Mathers kind of faded out after the destruction of the Golden Dawn. You know, he came in later, and he tried to actually sue Crowley for publishing, like, Golden Dawn rituals and stuff. He kind of faded out, you know.
I thought he was in the beginning of Wicca there at some point, too.
No, I haven't got any documentation toward that regard. Anyhow, you might be right, you know. I've read a lot on the formation of the early Wiccan about Gerald Gardner. I've read his books. Witchcraft Today was his very first one. And nobody mentions Mathers at all in those books. But you might be right. You know, I mean, I'm a scholar, but I don't know everything, for heaven's sake.
I may be remembering wrong as well.
I would be very interesting to see that. But I can't see any connection between the Golden Dawn system and the Wiccan religion at all. I can see a lot of connections. I mean, the Wiccans have their three levels and stuff. There's no connection between that. I can see a lot of connection between the OTO, because Crowley rewrote the OTO rituals, and they follow the same kind of pattern you see in the Golden Dawn. And Crowley worked the Golden Dawn system his whole life. I mean, when he was 60, he declared himself an Ipsissimuth, which is the highest degree of the Golden Dawn. So he actually followed that degree system his entire life. So he was heavily influenced by the Golden Dawn. But I just don't see it in the Wiccan religion. I don't see any Mathers influence at all. But it's possible. And if anybody's got any information about that, be sure to contact me. I'd love to know about that.
Talk a little bit about what chaos magic is for people who don't know. Because we've mentioned it a few times, but I don't think you've really defined it for people.
Well, I have some little trouble with chaos magic, because I've read those books you talk about, and I don't quite agree with their interpretation of quantum physics. I would argue that Peter Carroll has a very imperfect or layman's view of quantum physics. I don't think he really understands. I mean, nobody really understands quantum physics. The physicists themselves say they don't understand, you know, but
right.
I'm not so sure about his interpretation.
And we're talking about Psychonaut and Liber Null by Carroll.
Yeah. Yeah, but what the chaos magicians do is basically they argue that it's actually designed for a solitary magical practitioner. You know, now they have a system, they call them fathers and sorors, brothers and sisters, just like any kind of order like that. But what they're interested in is just simply you construct your own entities. And entities are like mental constructs. They call them egregores, which you actually create yourself. They leave aside the whole question about whether these things actually exist or not, because it's not really important. You've got this magical entity, and either you create yourself, it's create all your subconsciousness, or it's an actually ontologically existing entity. And we don't know. We can't really prove where it is or not. So you're dealing with these entities, and what you're trying to do is disconnect your rationality, because when the rationality steps in, you don't get as effective a ritual. So what he tries to do is find ways for you to kind of disconnect the rationality so that you don't really know what you're doing at all. And then what you do is you embody what you're trying to do in a form of a talisman. And then the talisman is designed in such a way where it's kind of unconsciously you know what the talisman represents, but you don't know intellectually what's going on. And then according to the theory is you divorce yourself from rationality to such a point where the magical practices will work on the unconscious or on the subconscious levels. And it's a little flawed, that kind of thinking is flawed, because I don't think you can ever fully disconnect the rational from the subconscious, you know. But that's what they try and do. And he derived that from Austin Osman Spare. And that's what Austin Osman Spare, if you ever look at his magical systems, his seagulls that he does for magical workings, they bear no resemblance to your standard pentagrams or hexagrams or anything like that. And they're totally self-created. You know, so what they're trying to do is just keep the rationality out entirely. And they're trying to keep you away from, like, these organized religions, because they claim that's a distraction. Like, think about the OTO for a minute. You join an organization like that, and pretty soon you're not really practicing magic at all. You're involved in like a Masonic organization. You're involved in a little petty politics and who's right, who's this, you know, getting together with groups and debating things rather than practicing under the stars, practicing your magical craft. So when you join organizations, you kind of get away from that. And I think that's the original premise for chaos magic, you know, whether it actually is true or not, you know. But they try and claim that there's nothing real, magical phenomena aren't real, and then you have to kind of create your own system, basically.
Yeah, it's sort of a projection of yourself. Like, there is no other. You create and work with what you create and put out there.
Yeah, and people have associated Lovecraft with that. You know, there's Richard Metzinger wrote in his book, The Disinformation Thing, he argues that Lovecraft's fiction actually is kind of a future primitivism. I talk about that a little bit, where it's actually very similar to the chaos magicians. They would argue, a chaos magician would argue like Lovecraft did, that we're kind of like in a meaningless cosmos, and that the human will and imagination are kind of like flukes. They're like quantum effects. And so you have to kind of accept that. You have to kind of accept that, and you have to build your practice is based upon that, the fact that it's not real at all and that ultimately it might not mean anything.
And that's kind of where Lovecraft excels in his horror, is that feeling of insignificance.
Oh, yeah. If you want to get that, you know, like read The Color Out of Space, that story that I was talking about before. You read that and you get the sense when you read that. You get an uneasy feeling about the cosmos. You know, usually if you read a horror story, you don't get uneasy feelings about the cosmos and your place in it. You're actually afraid of something very tangible, like The Walking Dead, for instance. You watch The Walking Dead. There are two things that you should be afraid of there, bad people or zombies.
Right.
Stuff, but they're very tangible. There's no cosmic fear. There's no deep psychological angst. But when you read Lovecraft, you're not afraid of something tangible like that. You're not afraid of giant monsters, giant lizards. You're not even afraid of extraterrestrials. You're afraid of the great out there that we can't really understand at all. And it's kind of scary. It's kind of scary. It's not comforting. You know, there is no God watching over you, wanting to save you. You believe in Jesus, and then by believing in him, you achieve contact with a very nice paternalistic God. Usually the Christians visualize him in profile with a white beard, a kindly figure. There isn't any of that in Lovecraft's cosmos. It's very bleak, it's very scary, but it's very real and potent. And he's the only writer that I've ever encountered that's able to do that. It's amazing.
And he did it so long ago. I mean, he was so far ahead of his time.
Yeah, that's why I think he's still relevant today. Like when you read Cthulhu Mythos fiction, a lot of times they take a different direction, and then pretty soon they become monsters.
Yeah.
You know, like there'll become monsters. They become very tangible horrors and stuff, but there's only a very few writers that actually follow suit and capture that cosmicism. A very few amount that do that. And Lovecraft does it better than even them, you know. So I would argue that in the 21st century, Lovecraft is never going to go out of style. Unless science goes out of style, unless quantum physics goes out of style, as long as we have these kind of intellectual disciplines and people are questing for something more, or understanding their place in the cosmos, or they're not, no place in the cosmos, the nothingness of the cosmos, as long as we have this kind of mental activity, Lovecraft is going to be predominant. I put Lovecraft up there. I'm not kidding. I put his mentality up there right next to Einstein.
Hmm.
I really do.
And he was kind of an introvert.
Yeah, I guess you could call that. The thing about Lovecraft was they developed a wide circle of friends, mainly through correspondence. But he was very gregarious within that group. You know, he would visit his friends. They would go on walking tours. He'd go to a place like New York. He lived in New York for a while. He'd go down south. He'd go to Charleston, place like that. And he would meet up with his friends. He had a whole wide circle of friends. And he was very gregarious and very outgoing with those people. But I guess you'd have to call him an introvert, where just regular casual acquaintances like the kind we have. Like, I'm a college professor, right? I know a lot of people in the department. You say hi to, you nod to them and stuff. Casual acquaintances. He was very weak when it came to that sort of thing.
And of course, as many people have noted, there's a bit of racism going through his stories. And
And you cannot deny that racism. You know, some people like to sugarcoat that. And what I do, like I actually talk about that in my on my website, the racism, that bothers a lot of people. But there's just no way of getting around that. Some people can. And he had a very disdainful attitude toward Jews, Italians, Poles, Asian people. He didn't like African Americans at all. He didn't mind using the N-word, okay? And some people argue that his entity, Shub Niggurath, was actually a product of his racism. Shub suggesting something subhuman.
Right.
Niggurath suggesting the N-word. And that might be true. You know, what his friends and his close friends did is that they didn't like that aspect of Lovecraft, but they kind of tried to whitewash it. Because Lovecraft did get married. He married somebody named Sonia Green, who was Jewish. And they argued that Lovecraft didn't dislike different cultures when he actually met them face to face. He just kind of disliked them in the abstract. But that doesn't wash out with me at all. And the reason why is because he married Sonia, but Sonia was white-colored. She looked just like him. She sounded like him. She was a duck. She looked like a duck and quacked like a duck, right? So he didn't care about her ethnic background. Lovecraft would not have married Sonia if she was an African-American woman. He wouldn't have been able to do that because that would be an obvious ethnic thing that you just can't get around. And what people have to do, S.T. Joshi used to kind of whitewash that in his earlier works, making that kind of argument. But Joshi's actually gotten more rational about that. He says we just can't give him a get-out-of-jail-free card for that. He was a racist. You can't say, well, a lot of people were racist back then. Well, yeah, there was a lot of racism, but there were always people that could stand above racism in Lovecraft's day, even before that. Waldo Emerson stood above racism back in the 1800s when the Civil War was going on. And Abraham Lincoln did too, but his was political. He freed the slaves not because he thought the blacks and whites were equal, but he did it for political reasons, you know, to mend the country. You know, he didn't actually have a high opinion. Same thing with Thomas Jefferson. You know, they say, well, Jefferson was a liberal guy. You notice Jefferson didn't free his slaves until after he died. In his will, he freed him, you know, so he didn't think blacks and whites were equal either. But there were certain people, nevertheless, during the period that could stand above that, like Ralph Waldo Emerson, say blacks and whites are equal. And Lovecraft, in his day, a lot of his friends could do that. Lovecraft couldn't. And I don't think we can give him a stay-out-of-jail-free card for that. And the problem with that is that it's actually damaged his reputation. They were going to have a statue. They had a commemoration where they were going to do a bust for him, a statue, and induct him into, like, some kind of science fiction hall of fame. And then they quickly revoked the idea because of his racism. And S.T. Joshi got all upset about it. You know, he said he hopes they'll never induct him into anything. He's not going to have anything more to do with them. That's kind of an extreme example. You can't do that. That's like the Amish, right? You know, they don't like modern culture, so they kind of rebel from it and form their own community. That's not an answer. That's a cop-out.
Okay. And gender is also plays a part here. He doesn't have a lot of female characters, despite being raised by women, essentially.
He was raised by women. In fact, he lived with his aunt when his house got sold off. That was a big traumatic incident for him. He started living with his aunts, and then he lived with Sonia for a time in New York, but he couldn't stand New York, so the kind of marriage kind of fell apart when he moved back to Providence. But he stayed with his aunts in various places, and so you're right, he was around a lot of women, right? The thing about Lovecraft is, you're right, there's not a lot of female characters, but the interesting thing is that what they really mean by that is there's not a lot of romantic love in Lovecraft. You know, and that's what Hollywood always gets wrong whenever they do a Lovecraft thing, like the movie Stuart Gordon's Dagon. They have a main character that's kind of like a Lovecraftian character, and then they got to throw in a really hot-looking woman to be his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. You know, Lovecraft didn't throw in hot-looking women, okay? But he did have women characters. He had very scary, kind of terrifying women characters, and they were very powerful women. One of the most interesting characters I like is, and actually she's kind of sexy too, in The Thing on the Doorstep, he has a character named Azanath Waite, mm-hmm. who is actually a real hot, kind of a blonde woman, and she meets the main character when they're in college, and then they get married. But you find out, this is a very interesting character, you find out that she's actually not really a woman, but she's actually been possessed by her father, who was a man. So it's actually the main character falls in love with a woman, it's actually a man. Think about that for a minute, right, in terms of gender studies. But in addition to that, Azanath Waite's relatives are from Innsmouth, and so what they did, they mated with a different race of cultures, fish-frog cultures. So Azanath Waite will ultimately turn into a fish-frog character when she's, if she hadn't been possessed by her father, she would have turned into a different species altogether after she got older. And so think about that character. That's not only a transgendered woman in the fullest sense. This isn't transgendered like GLBT people. This is really transgender. That's the actual man inside the woman's body. But she's also trans species because she's a different species altogether. Think about that. That story was written in 1933. How many characters can you name being a protagonist, the main character of a story that's not only transgender but trans species and a woman to boot in a science fiction story? This is a time when they were doing Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, where women were kind of subordinate. They were kind of like sex objects, and the men were going around like Tarzan and John Carter. They're going around having experiences. The women are just kind of like ornaments, basically. Think about that in 1933. There's a character like that.
True, true. I never really thought about it like that. All right.
And he feared women. Lovecraft feared women. He was had a very low sex drive. And so when he does picture women, he pictures them as being these unconventional kind of women, like Azanath Waite, and they kind of personify for him the unknown, darkness, chaos, death, his suspicions that women are in touch with forces that he feels very uneasy about. So they kind of reflect his own nighttime dreamings, you know. So you can learn a lot from Lovecraft, even in terms of gender.
All right. Well, the book, again, is H.P. Lovecraft and the Black Magical Tradition, the master of horror's influence on modern occultism. And as well as Lovecraft, it also, as I said, it gives you, you did a very good job of, like, giving an overview of a lot of different magical systems, from Satanism to Kenneth Grant stuff to chaos magic and Wicca and voodoo. And we didn't really get into the Satanism part of it, but Anton LaVey did use some of Lovecraft's stuff as well.
Yeah, on the Satanic Rituals, he wrote a book called The Satanic Rituals in 1972 that followed the Satanic Bible. And the rituals were actually written by a name, Michael Aquino, who's actually the head of the Temple of Set.
Yeah.
So he kind of broke away from Anton LaVey. But he's got a whole section on Lovecraft. He's got two rituals, and I've done those two rituals, by the way. I did them when I was younger, and they're based on Lovecraftian theme. So Anton LaVey was heavily influenced by Lovecraft, and the Temple Set was too. Are we getting ready to wrap this up? Can I plug some things?
Absolutely. I was going to ask you to.
Okay. I want to plug my website, first of all,
okay.
www.johnlstedman.com. www.thefringe.com. On that website, you'll find all my events in kind of a chronological order and other things like frequently asked questions about Lovecraft and information about my book. I'm on Facebook, of course. I have a very lively Facebook thing going on. Whenever people go on my Facebook account, you can always find whenever interviews like this one are uploaded or available for download, I always put links on Facebook so you can listen to all my interviews. I have all my events on Facebook and Twitter when I have them. I've got a book signing in May at the Barnes & Noble in Cleveland, Ohio, at the Case Western Reserve University. So that's a college bookstore. I have toward the end, I've got other events, but I'm not going to mention them until they're confirmed. In August, I'm going to be giving a presentation at the Pagan Pride event in Detroit, Michigan. And I'm going to have a two-day event at the Carnival of Power Horror in Buffalo, New York,
really?
The 27th through 28th. Yeah, I'm going to do a presentation on Lovecraft's cosmic stories and American cinema. So that'll be a fun one. That goes over 2 days in August, the 27th through 28th. And then I got another book signing in September at the Barnes & Noble in Georgia Tech down in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, so those will all be detailed on my website. You can keep track of me on Facebook and Twitter. And I love it when people contact me. A lot of people say, you know, I just heard your interview on this or on that, and I'll be glad to respond and talk to people about that. I want to ask you one more question before I let you go. I love the name of your radio show, Where Did the Road Go? That is so cool. What are you implying by that? Is that a hard one?
It's kind of a hard one. I mean, I'm implying that we're trying to go places that other people haven't gone before.
Okay.
You know, trying to delve into some of these unexplained things in ways that haven't been looked at before.
I was curious because I'm looking at this picture here, and you have this interesting picture of a road, and it looks like it's deviating toward the left, and it's darkness in there, like it's a dark thing. Are you implying that the road disappears after a while, and then you're traveling, and you're suddenly not in our space-time continuum at all?
I do like that implication.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, it's a great title. You know, a lot of them are called, like, I did a Dr. J's radio live show the other day. They'll call it Dr. J, or they'll call it, like, Dark Sun Rising, or things like that. But I love the when I saw that, Where Did the Road Go? I thought it was cute, first of all, that it had a question mark, because I love question marks. But I just thought it was a great title for a radio show.
And your next book, too. Tell people about that.
Yeah, that's going to be H.P. Lovecraft's Magical Persona and the Cthulhu Mythos. And what I do is I argue that Lovecraft developed a concept of the magical persona, and that he uses this predominantly in his major works to articulate his views about humanity, mankind, the universe, space, the cosmos, everything that was of interest to him. And the reason why I wrote this book is because the criticism of Lovecraft has been under the domination of S.T. Joshi and other scholars that have kind of followed blindly behind him, arguing that after 1926, Lovecraft demythologized his entities and didn't deal with supernatural explanations at all. That's completely wrong. And what Joshi does is he knows that that's completely wrong. But then what he does in his books, he discredits all the stories after 1926 that have a supernatural theme. He'll say, like, The Thing on the Doorstep, which is totally supernatural. Dunwich Horror, totally supernatural.
Yeah.
Lovecraft's very last story, The Haunter of the Dark, totally supernatural. He'll discredit these stories and say they're just not as good as Lovecraft's other stories, but he ignores the point that it contradicts what he's talking about, because they do have supernatural elements. And so I wanted to respond to that, because there's a whole body of critical literature and belief that Lovecraft actually was writing strict on cosmic non-supernatural art, and he was doing nothing of the kind. And what I do is I've read everything, and I attack all the critics, including S.T. Joshi, and I give a very balanced, accurate reading of all of Lovecraft's major stories. I start out with talking about how he developed the concept from three of his favorite writers, Edgar Allan Poe, Nathaniel Hawthorne, M.R. James. The middle part of the book is just an analysis of those major stories. And it's a very penetrating, deep analysis of those stories. You won't find this anywhere else. And I started out as a literary critic, by the way, so this is my forte. And then in the latter part of the book, I talk about how the magical personas influenced writers of Cthulhu mythos fiction starting in the 1930s and going all the way up to the present time, 2000 and in 12, you know. So it's a very good book. It's kind of a big book. It's in the hands of the publishers, and I'm out here promoting this one because I think this is a really good, useful book for everybody. But also, I want to sell a lot of copies of this book so they'll buy the other one. Otherwise, I have to pay for it myself, and I hate spending my own money on anything.
Well, I guess that's true of all of us. All right. Well, I thank you, John. If you'd stick around for a few minutes, we can do a little extra segment for our patrons, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And we're going to take you out tonight with Nightmares from Psyche Corporation. And here we go.
Shut the closet door. It's under the floor. The monster's there. The day I was born, you promised me hellfire. You were so sure I grew up waiting for demons to find me. I grew up hungry for ghosts to define me. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Sign of your suffering, bitterness, suffering, offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me.